This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's rarely easy to admit that you've been wrong. But of course, everyone makes mistakes. Scientists are no different than anyone else in this regard. But when a researcher makes a poor choice in the lab or misinterprets his or her own results, no matter how honest that mistake, when it becomes part of the permanent scientific record, it can have far-reaching implications. A new project is offering scientists who later change their opinions or discount their own previous data an opportunity to make that known to others so that the whole field can benefit and progress. It's called the Loss of Confidence Project. Dalmeet Singh Chawla is a freelance science journalist who has written about that project for UnDark magazine. Dalmeet, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, Heather. How are you?
I'm doing well. Tell me about this Loss of Confidence Project. What would prompt a scientist to want to post a loss of confidence statement or engage with this project?
Lots of things, Heather. So, the reproducibility issue or the lack of reproducibility of science, you know, has hit the headlines in the last few years. And, you know, science is supposed to be self-correcting, you know, but many of the incentives to self-correct your own work aren't, you know, routinely is in place, or, you know, incentives to correct the literature isn't. So some researchers are now starting to come forward and, you know, kind of admit mistakes in the form of loss of confidence statements. And this project, it's even the researchers that are launching the project admit that it's an idealistic approach to scientific self-correction. But the idea is that offering a chance for the researchers to come forward and say, hey, you know what, I don't believe something that I used to. Some researchers have done that. You know, the most high profile case of that is about the author or the co-author of a 2010 study about power poses, which is basically the theory that suggests that making powerful stances helps one physiologically and psychologically under high pressure situations. That came under scrutiny after one of the authors came out and said, you know what, actually, I don't believe that anymore. It kind of raised a lot of eyebrows, and people in the field, psychology, generally welcome that.
There's a difference between, I interpreted my data in light of what we knew at the time, and now we know more, and I don't hold that same interpretation anymore. That's very different than, you know, I falsified data. I doctored photos, I made up data points. And when it's something that is that egregious, there are formal ways for that to be addressed, for studies to be pulled from the published literature, retracted, and public notices made about this. This is a little bit more subtle, though.
Yeah, certainly. So you're right, absolutely. Loss of confidence, if a researcher comes forward with a loss of confidence statement, it doesn't necessarily mean that that researcher should go and, you know, retract their study or correct their study in the literature.
You mentioned earlier this idea that science should be self-correcting, and of course it should be reproducible. That's kind of a central part of the scientific method that we're taught in school, is that when you share a study that you've done, you should basically give other researchers the instructions they need to reproduce your study and get the same result. Why is that not happening? Why are we faced with, as you called it, a reproducibility crisis in certain parts of science?
Yeah. So it's more in some disciplines than other, I would like to point out. So psychology, and particularly social psychology, has been hit hard by the so-called reproducibility crisis, Heather. And, other fields are facing it too. You know, a survey done in 2016 by the journal Nature, it suggested that, you know, some of the most confident researchers about the literature in their field are chemists and physicists. You know, those are fields where, there's more standard procedures that one follows, for instance. However, yes, you're right. There's a lot more, talk of reproducibility. And that's partly, due to the realization that researchers have been using not good enough statistical methods or using very small samples, etc. That's just been realized in the last few years, even even though some of these practices have held up for decades. You know, one researcher, for instance, one psychologist told me recently that his methodological awakening, you know, happened in 2012. So I think partly it's just that because there's been more of a realization and more people looking into the issue that we've come forward. You know, there's also been recent projects. One project, for instance, looked at a bunch of psychology studies, 98 high-profile psychology papers from three journals, and, you know, only around 39% of those, you know, were reproducible. Similarly, the biotechnology firm Amgen looked at some cancer papers, and, you know, only 6 out of, you know, 50-something studies, you know, were reproducible, and that's pretty poor. So, you know, after these high-profile studies really hit the headlines, people started to realize, you know, this is more of an issue, you know, than we think. Although there are some people out there, some researchers who think the reproducibility issue in psychology is kind of, you know, overstated or over-exaggerated.
Well, and at the same time, it also sounds like because these studies are coming out showing how reproducible or not certain types of studies are, scientists are changing their methods as they learn which methods work and which ones don't. I mean, that just sounds like that's how science should progress. Is this really a crisis?
Well, that's the thing, Heather. So this is why, this is the argument that some people are saying, well, you know what? These were the gold standard processes at that time. So, the fact that some of these studies are not holding up doesn't mean, you know, they should be retracted, for instance, because, you know, they were, as long as they were, so this is the argument of some researchers that say, as long as a study was done in good faith at that time, so not with, you know, deliberately fraudulent practices or questionable research practices or, you know, using deliberately shoddy statistics or that sort of thing, then these should remain in literature. But because there wasn't a clear way of reporting, these instances where although they were done in good faith, there was still no, they still didn't hold up to scrutiny. There was no way of reporting those instances, which is where the loss of confidence project fits in. It's kind of saying, okay, if you no longer believe a study that you used to, let's come forward and say that. But the condition is that the author coming forward must be willing to take responsibility, primary responsibility, for the methodological and theoretical problems with that paper. So you're right. To a certain extent, it is just science being science, you know, because science is very difficult.
What would you say to members of the public who are hearing this and thinking, gee, what should I believe or not when I hear about a new study? Should this prompt a loss of confidence in science on the part of the public?
Well, I don't think we need to go to that far. I think the consumers of science, the public, they should be critical when looking at scientific coverage. They should question it, and they should, you know, just bear in mind that researchers are also human beings. So, you know, as long as they're critical, they look at scientific coverage, and they don't blindly believe every single word, I think that should be a fairly good way to go about things.
Dalmeet Singh Chawla is a freelance science journalist who has written about the Loss of Confidence Project for UnDark magazine. Dalmeet, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Heather. Take care.